Your old or broken phone can let you down when you need it most.
Perfect.
But at Verizon, trade in any old phone from our top brands and get the most for it. Up to $2,000 in value for an amazing new iPhone 16 Pro with Apple Intelligence and a new line on my plan. And iPad and Apple Watch Series 10. That's like a 3-for-1. And you can get it on any plan. At Verizon, trade in your old phone for a brand new iPhone 16 Pro, iPad, and Apple Watch. The other guys won't give you that. Visit Verizon.com today. Additional terms apply. Service plan required for Apple Watch and iPad. Up to $2,000 value based on iPhone, iPad, and Apple Watch.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Chapter 14 of Rupert of Hentzau. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please go to LibriVox.org. Recording by Andy Minter. Rupert of Hentzau. Taken from the memoirs of Fritz von Tarlenheim. By Anthony Hope. Chapter 14. The News Comes to Strelsau. On leaving No. 19, Rischenheim walked swiftly some little way up the Königstrasse and then hailed a cab. He had hardly raised his hand when he heard his name called, and looking round saw Anton von Strofzin's smart phaeton pulling up beside him. Anton was driving, and on the other seat was a large nosegay of choice flowers.
"Where are you off to?" cried Anton, leaning forward with a gay smile.
"Well, where are you? To a lady's, I presume, from your bouquet there?" answered Rischenheim, as lightly as he could.
"The little bunch of flowers," simpered young Anton, "is a cousinly offering to Helga von Tarlenheim, and I am going to present it. Can I give you a lift anywhere?"
Although Rischenheim had intended to go first to the palace, Anton's offer seemed to give him a good excuse for drawing the more likely covert first.
"I was going to the palace to find out where the king is. I want to see him, if he'll give me a minute or two," he remarked.
"I'll drive you there afterwards. Jump up. That's your cab. Here you are, cabman."
And flinging the cabman a crown, he displaced the bouquet and made room for Rischenheim beside him. Anton's horses, of which he was not a little proud, made short work of the distance to my home. The phaeton rattled up to the door, and both young men got out. The moment of their arrival found the Chancellor just leaving to return to his own home. Helsing knew them both, and stopped to rally Anton on the matter of his bouquet. Anton was famous for his bouquets, which he distributed widely among the ladies of Strelsau.
"I hoped it was for my daughter," said the Chancellor slyly, "for I love flowers, and my wife has ceased to provide me with them. Moreover, I've ceased to provide her with them, so but for my daughter we should have none."
Anton answered his chaff, promising a bouquet for the young lady the next day, but declaring that he would not disappoint his cousin. He was interrupted by Rischenheim, who, looking round on the group of bystanders, now grown numerous, exclaimed,
"What's going on here, my dear Chancellor? What are all these people hanging about here for? Ah, that's a royal carriage."
"The Queen is with the Countess," answered Helsing. "The people are waiting to see her come out."
"She is always worth seeing,"
Anton pronounced, sticking his glass in his eye.
"And you've been to visit her?" pursued Rischenheim.
"Why, yes, I went to pay my respects, my dear Rischenheim."
"An early visit?"
"It was more or less on business."
"Ah, I have business also, and very important business, but it's with the king."
"I won't keep you a moment, Rischenheim," called Anton, as, bouquet in hand, he knocked at the door.
"With the king," said Helsing. "Ah, yes, but the king..." "I'm on my way to the palace to find out where he is. If I can't see him, I must write at once. My business is very urgent."
"Indeed, my dear Count, dear me, urgent, you say?
But perhaps you can help me. Is he at Zenda?" The Chancellor was becoming very embarrassed. Anton had disappeared into the house. Rischenheim buttonholed him resolutely.
At Zenda? Well, now, I don't... excuse me, but what is your business?
Excuse me, my dear Chancellor, it's a secret.
I have the King's confidence.
Then you'll be indifferent to not enjoying mine, smiled Rischenheim.
I perceive that your arm is hurt, observed the Chancellor, seeking a diversion.
Between ourselves, that has something to do with my business. Well, I must go to the palace, or... Stay, would Her Majesty condescend to help me? I think I'll risk a request. She can but refuse.
And so saying, Rischenheim approached the door. Oh, my friend, I wouldn't do that, cried Helsing, darting after him. The Queen is very much engaged. She won't like to be troubled.
Rischenheim took no notice of him, but knocked loudly. The door was opened, and he told the butler to carry his name to the Queen and beg a moment's speech with her. Helsing stood in perplexity on the step. The crowd was delighted with the coming of these great folk, and showed no signs of dispersing. Anton von Strofzin did not reappear. Rischenheim edged himself inside the doorway, and stood on the threshold of the hall. There he heard voices proceeding from the sitting-room on the left. He recognised the Queen's, my wife's, and Anton's. Then came the butler's, saying, "I will inform the Count of Your Majesty's wishes." The door of the room opened, the butler appeared, and immediately behind him Anton von Strofzin and Bernenstein. Bernenstein had the young fellow by the arm, and hurried him through the hall. They passed the butler, who made way for them, and came to where Rischenheim stood.
"We meet again," said Rischenheim with a bow.
The Chancellor rubbed his hands in nervous perturbation. The butler stepped up and delivered his message. The Queen regretted her inability to receive the Count. Rischenheim nodded, and standing so that the door could not be shut, asked Bernenstein whether he knew where the King was. Now Bernenstein was most anxious to get the pair of them away and the door shut, but he dared show no eagerness. "Do you want another interview with the King already?" he asked with a smile. "The last was so pleasant, then." Rischenheim took no notice of the taunt, but observed sarcastically, "There's a strange difficulty in finding our good King. The Chancellor here doesn't know where he is, or at least he won't answer my questions."
"Possibly the King has his reasons for not wishing to be disturbed," suggested Bernenstein.
"It's very possible," retorted Rischenheim significantly.
"Meanwhile, my dear Count, I shall take it as a personal favour if you'll move out of the doorway."
"Do I incommode you by standing here?" answered the Count.
"Infinitely, my lord," answered Bernenstein stiffly.
"Hello, Bernenstein, what's the matter?" cried Anton, seeing that their tones and glances had grown angry.
The crowd also had noticed the raised voices and hostile manner of the disputants, and began to gather round in a more compact group. Suddenly a voice came from inside the hall. It was distinct and loud, yet not without a touch of huskiness. The sound of it hushed the rising quarrel, and silenced the crowd into expectant stillness. Bernenstein looked aghast, Rischenheim nervous yet triumphant, Anton amused and gratified.
"The King!" he cried, and burst into a laugh. "You've drawn him, Rischenheim!"
The crowd heard his boyish exclamation and raised a cheer. Helsing turned as though to rebuke them. Had not the King himself desired secrecy? Yes. But he who spoke as the King chose any risk sooner than let Rischenheim go back and warn Rupert of his presence.
"Is that the Count of Lutzau, Rischenheim?" called Rudolf from within. "If so, let him enter, and then shut the door."
There was something in his tone that alarmed Rischenheim. He started back on the step, but Bernenstein caught him by the arm.
"Since you wish to come in, come in," he said with a grim smile.
Rischenheim looked round, as though he meditated flight. The next moment Bernenstein was thrust aside. For one short instant a tall figure appeared in the doorway. The crowd had but a glimpse, yet they cheered again. Rischenheim's hand was clasped in a firm grip. He passed unwillingly, but helplessly, through the door. Bernenstein followed. The door was shut. Anton faced round on Helsing, a scornful twist on his lips. "There was a deuced lot of mystery about nothing," said he. "Why couldn't you say he was there?" And without waiting for an answer from the outraged and bewildered Chancellor, he swung down the steps and climbed into his phaeton. The people round were chatting noisily, delighted to have caught a glimpse of the King, speculating what brought him and the Queen to my house, and hoping that they would soon come out and get into the royal carriage that stood waiting. Had they been able to see inside the door, their emotion would have been stirred to a keener pitch. Rudolf himself caught Rischenheim by the arm, and without a moment's delay led him towards the back of the house. They went along a passage and reached a small room that looked out on the garden. Rudolf had known my house in the old days, and did not forget its resources. "Shut the door, Bernenstein," said Rudolf. Then he turned to Rischenheim. "My lord," he said, "I suppose you came to find out something. Do you know it now?" Rischenheim plucked up courage to answer him. "Yes, I know now that I have to deal with an impostor," said he defiantly. "Precisely. And impostors can't afford to be exposed." Rischenheim's cheek turned rather pale. Rudolf faced him, and Bernenstein guarded the door. He was absolutely at their mercy, and he knew their secret. Did they know his, the news that Rupert of Hentzau had brought? "Listen," said Rudolf. "For a few hours today I am king in Strelsau. In those few hours I have an account to settle with your cousin. Something that he has, I must have. I am going now to seek him, and while I seek him you will stay here with Bernenstein. Perhaps I shall fail, and perhaps I shall succeed. Whether I succeed or fail, by tonight I shall be far from Strelsau, and the king's place will be free for him again." Rischenheim gave a slight start, and a look of triumph spread over his face. They did not know that the king was dead. Rudolf came nearer to him, fixing his eyes steadily on his prisoner's face. "I don't know," he continued, "why you are in this business, my lord. Your cousin's motives I know well, but I wonder that they seem to you great enough to justify the ruin of an unhappy lady who is your queen. Be assured that I will die sooner than let that letter reach the king's hand." Rischenheim made him no answer. "Are you armed?" asked Rudolf. Rischenheim suddenly flung his revolver on the table. Bernenstein came forward and took it. "Keep him here, Bernenstein. When I return, I'll tell you what more to do. If I don't return, Fritz will be here soon, and you and he must make your own plans." "He shan't give me the slip a second time," said Bernenstein. "We hold ourselves free," said Rudolf to Rischenheim, "to do what we please with you, my lord, but I have no wish to cause your death, unless it be necessary. You will be wise to wait till your cousin's fate is decided, before you attempt any further steps against us." And with a slight bow, he left the prisoner in Bernenstein's charge, and went back to the room where the queen awaited him. Helga was with her. The queen sprang up to meet him. "I mustn't lose a moment," he said. "All that crowd of people know now that the king is here. The news will filter through the town in no time. We must send word to Sapt to keep it from the king's ears at all costs. I must go and do my work, and then disappear." The queen stood facing him. Her eyes seemed to devour his face, but she said only, "Yes, it must be so." "You must return to the palace as soon as I am gone. I shall send out and ask the people to disperse, and then I must be off."
"To seek Rupert of Hentzau?"
"Yes." She struggled for a moment with the contending feelings that filled her heart. Then she came to him and seized hold of his hand.
"Don't go," she said, in low, trembling tones. "Don't go, Rudolf. He'll kill you. Never mind the letter. Don't go. I'd rather a thousand times that the king had it than that you should... Oh, my dear, don't go."
"I must go," he said softly. Again she began to implore him, but he would not yield. Helga moved towards the door, but Rudolf stopped her. "No," he said, "you must stay with her. You must go to the palace with her." Even as he spoke, they heard the wheels of a carriage driven quickly to the door. By now I had met Anton von Strofzin, and heard from him that the king was at my house.
As I dashed up, the news was confirmed by the comments and jokes of the crowd.
"Oh, he's in a hurry," they said. "He's kept the king waiting. He'll get a wigging."
As may be supposed, I paid little heed to them. I sprang out and ran up the steps to the door. I saw my wife's face at the window. She herself ran to the door and opened it for me.
"Good God," I whispered, "do all these people know he's here and take him for the king?" "Yes," she said, "we couldn't help it. He showed himself at the door."
It was worse than I dreamt. Not two or three people, but all that crowd were victims of the mistake. All of them had heard that the king was in Strelsau, aye, and had seen him. "Where is he? Where is he?" I asked, and followed her hastily to the room. The queen and Rudolf were standing side by side. What I have told from Helga's description had just passed between them. Rudolf ran to meet me. "Is all well?" he asked eagerly. I forgot the queen's presence and paid no sign of respect to her. I caught Rudolf by the arm and cried to him, "Do they take you for the king?" "Yes," he said. "Heavens, man, don't look so white. We shall manage it. I can be gone by tonight."
"Gone? How will that help, since they believe you to be the king?"
"You can keep it from the king," he urged. "I couldn't help it. I can settle with Rupert and disappear." The three were standing round me, surprised at my great and terrible agitation. Looking back now, I wonder that I could speak to them at all. Rudolf tried again to reassure me. He little knew the cause of what he saw. "It won't take long to settle affairs with Rupert," said he, "and we must have the letter, or it will get to the king after all."
"The king will never see the letter,"
I blurted out as I sank back in a chair. They said nothing. I looked round on their faces. I had a strange feeling of helplessness, and seemed able to do nothing but throw the truth at them in blunt plainness. Let them make what they could of it. I could make nothing.
"The king will never see the letter," I repeated.
"Rupert himself has ensured that."
"What do you mean? You've not met Rupert. You've not got the letter."
"No, no, but the king can never read it."
Then Rudolf seized me by the shoulder and fairly shook me. Indeed, I must have seemed like a man in a dream or torpor.
"Why not, Anne? Why not?"
he asked in urgent low tones. Again I looked at them, but somehow this time my eyes were attracted and held by the queen's face. I believe that she was the first to catch a hint of the tidings I brought. Her lips were parted, and her gaze eagerly strained upon me. I rubbed my hand across my forehead, and looking up stupidly at her, I said, "He can never see the letter. He's dead." There was a little scream from Helga. Rudolf neither spoke nor moved. The queen continued to gaze at me in motionless wonder and horror.
"Rupert killed him," said I. "The boar hound attacked Rupert. Then Herbert and the king attacked him, and he killed them all."
"Yes, the king is dead. He's dead." Now none spoke. The queen's eyes never left my face. "Yes, he's dead," said I, and I watched her eyes still. For a long while, or so it seemed, they were on my face. At last, as though drawn by some irresistible force, they turned away. I followed the new line they took. She looked at Rudolf Rassendyll, and he at her. Helga had taken out her handkerchief, and utterly upset by the horror and shock, was lying back in a low chair, sobbing half hysterically. I saw the swift look that passed from the queen to her lover, carrying in it grief, remorse, and most unwilling joy. He did not speak to her, but put out his hand and took hers. She drew it away almost sharply, and covered her face with both hands. Rudolf turned to me.
"When was it?"
"Last night."
"And the... he's at the lodge?"
"Yes, with Sapt and James." I was recovering my senses and my coolness. "Nobody knows yet," I said. "We were afraid you might be taken for him by somebody. But my God, Rudolf, what's to be done now?" Mr. Rassendyll's lips were set firm and tight. He frowned slightly, and his blue eyes wore a curious, entranced expression. He seemed to me to be forgetful of everything, even of us who were with him, in some one idea that possessed him. The queen herself came nearer to him and lightly touched his arm with her hand. He started as though surprised, then fell again into his reverie.
"What's to be done, Rudolf?"
I asked again.
"I'm going to kill Rupert of Hentzau," he said. "The rest we'll talk of afterwards."
He walked rapidly across the room and rang the bell. "Clear those people away," he ordered. "Tell them that I want to be quiet. Then send a closed carriage round for me. Don't be more than 10 minutes."
The servant received his peremptory orders with a low bow and left us. The Queen, who had been all this time outwardly calm and composed, now fell into a great agitation, which even the consciousness of our presence could not enable her to hide.
"Rudolf, must you go, since this has happened?"
"Hush, my dearest lady," he whispered. Then he went on more loudly. "I won't quit Ruritania a second time, leaving Rupert of Hentzau alive. Fritz, send word to Sapt that the king is in Strelsau. He'll understand, and that instructions from the king follow by midday. When I have killed Rupert, I shall visit the lodge on my way to the frontier."
He turned to go, but the queen, following, detained him for a minute.
"You'll come and see me before you go?" she pleaded.
"But I ought not," said he,
his resolute eyes suddenly softening in a marvellous fashion.
"You will?"
"Yes, my queen."
Then I sprang up, for a sudden dread laid hold on me.
"Heavens, man," I cried, "what if he kills you, there in the Königstrasse?"
Rudolf turned to me. There was a look of surprise on his face.
"He won't kill me," he answered.
The queen, looking still in Rudolf's face, and forgetful now, as it seemed, of the dream that had so terrified her, took no notice of what I said, but urged again,
"You'll come, Rudolf?"
"Yes, once, my queen."
And with a last kiss of her hand, he was gone. The queen stood for yet another moment where she was, still and almost rigid. Then suddenly she walked or stumbled to where my wife sat, and flinging herself on her knees, hid her face in Helga's lap. I heard her sobs break out fast and tumultuously. Helga looked up at me, the tears streaming down her cheeks. I turned and went out. Perhaps Helga could comfort her. I prayed that God in his pity might send her comfort, although she, for her sin's sake, dared not ask it of him. Poor soul, I hope there may be nothing worse scored to my account. End of chapter 14. Chapter 15 of Rupert of Hentzau. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please go to LibriVox.org. Recording by Andy Minter. Rupert of Hentzau, taken from the memoirs of Fritz von Tarlenheim, by Anthony Hope. Chapter 15. A Pastime for Colonel Sapt. The constable of Zenda and James, Mr. Rassendyll's servant, sat at breakfast in the hunting lodge. They were in the small room which was ordinarily used as the bedroom of the gentleman in attendance on the king. They chose it now because it commanded a view of the approach. The door of the house was securely fastened. They were prepared to refuse admission. In case refusal was impossible, the preparations for concealing the king's body and that of his huntsman Herbert were complete. Inquirers would be told that the king had ridden out with his huntsman at daybreak, promising to return in the evening, but not stating where he was going. Sapt was under orders to await his return, and James was expecting instructions from his master, the Count of Tarlenheim. Thus armed against discovery, they looked for news from me, which should determine their future action. Meanwhile, there was an interval of enforced idleness. Sapt, his meal finished, puffed away at his great pipe. James, after much pressure, had consented to light a small black clay, and sat at his ease, with his legs stretched out before him. His brows were knit, and a curious half-smile played about his mouth.
"What may you be thinking about, friend James?" asked the constable, between two puffs.
He had taken a fancy to the alert, ready little fellow. James smoked for a moment, and then took his pipe from his mouth. "I was thinking, sir, that since the king is dead..." He paused.
"The king is no doubt dead, poor fellow," said Sapt, nodding.
"That since he's certainly dead, and since my master, Mr. Rassendyll, is alive..."
"So far as we know, James," Sapt reminded him.
"Why, yes, sir, so far as we know. Since, then, Mr. Rassendyll is alive, and the king is dead, I was thinking that it was a great pity, sir, that my master can't take his place and be king."
James looked across at the constable with an air of a man who offers a respectful suggestion. "A remarkable thought, James," observed the constable with a grin.
"You don't agree with me, sir?" asked James deprecatingly.
"I don't say that it isn't a pity, for Rudolf makes a good king. But you see it's impossible, isn't it?"
James nursed his knee between his hands, and his pipe, which he had replaced, stuck out of one corner of his mouth. "When you say impossible, sir," he remarked deferentially, "I venture to differ from you."
"You do? Come, we're at leisure. Let's hear how it would be possible."
"My master is in Strelsau, sir," began James.
"Well, most likely."
"I'm sure of it, sir. If he's been there, he will be taken for the king."
"That has happened before, and no doubt may happen again, unless..."
"Why, of course, sir, unless the king's body should be discovered."
"That's what I was about to say, James."
James kept silence for a few minutes. Then he observed, "It will be very awkward to explain how the king was killed."
"The story will need good telling," admitted Sapt.
"And it will be difficult to make it appear that the king was killed in Strelsau. Yet if my master should chance to be killed in Strelsau..."
"Heaven forbid, James, on all grounds, heaven forbid."
"Even if my master is not killed, it will be difficult for us to get the king killed at the right time, and by means that will seem plausible."
Sapt seemed to fall into the humour of the speculation. "That's all very true, but if Mr. Rassendyll is to be king, it will be both awkward and difficult to dispose of the king's body, and of this poor fellow Herbert," said he, sucking at his pipe.
Again James paused for a little while before he remarked, "I am, of course, sir, only discussing the matter by way of passing the time. It would probably be wrong to carry any such plan into effect."
"It might be, but let us discuss it, to pass the time," said Sapt, and he leant forward, looking into the servant's quiet, shrewd face.
"Well then, sir, since it amuses you, let us say that the king came to the lodge last night, and was joined there by his friend, Mr. Rassendyll."
"And did I come too?"
"You, sir, came also in attendance on the king."
"Well, and you, James, you came. How came you?"
"Why, sir, by the Count of Tarlenheim's orders to wait on Mr. Rassendyll, the king's friend. Now, the king, sir, this is my story, you know, sir, only my story..."
"Your story interests me. Get on with it."
"The king went out very early this morning, sir."
"That would be on private business."
"So we should have understood, but Mr. Rassendyll, Herbert, and ourselves remained here."
"Had the Count of Hentzau been?"
"Not to our knowledge, sir, but we were all tired, and slept very soundly."
"Now did we?" said the constable, with a grim smile.
"In fact, sir, we were all overcome with fatigue, Mr. Rassendyll like the rest, and full morning found us still in our beds. There we should be to this moment, sir, had we not been suddenly aroused in a startling and fearful manner."
"You should write story-books, James. Now, what was this fearful manner in which we were aroused?"
James laid down his pipe, and resting his hands on his knees, continued his story. "This lodge, sir, this wooden lodge, for the lodge is all of wood, sir, without and within."
"This lodge is undoubtedly of wood, James, and, as you say, both inside and out."
"'And since it is, sir, it would be mighty careless to leave a candle burning where the oil and firewood are stored.'
"'Most criminal.'
"'But hard words don't hurt dead men. And you see, sir, poor Herbert is dead.'
"'It is true. He wouldn't feel aggrieved.
"'But we, sir, you and I, awaking—'
"'Aren't the others to awake, James?'
"'Indeed, sir, I should pray that they had never awaked, "'for you and I, waking first, would find the lodge a mass of flames. "'We should have to run for our lives.'
"'What? Should we make no effort to rouse the others?'
"'Indeed, sir, we should do all that men could do. "'We should even risk death by suffocation.'
"'But we should fail, in spite of our heroism, should we?'
"'Alas, sir, in spite of all our efforts we should fail. "'The flames would envelop the lodge in one blaze. "'Before help could come the lodge would be in ruins, "'and my unhappy master and poor Herbert would be consumed to ashes.' "'They would, at least, sir, be entirely unrecognisable.'
"'You think so?'
"'Beyond doubt. If the oil and the firewood and the candle were placed to the best advantage.
Ah, yes. And there would be an end of Rudolf Rassendyll.
Sir, I should myself carry the tidings to his family.
Whereas the King of Ruritania
would enjoy a long and prosperous reign, God willing, sir.
And the Queen of Ruritania, James?
Do not misunderstand me, sir. They could be secretly married. I should say remarried.
Yes, certainly, remarried.
By a trustworthy priest.
You mean by an untrustworthy priest.
It's the same thing, sir, from a different point of view. For the first time, James smiled a thoughtful smile. Zapt, in his turn, laid down his pipe now, and was tugging at his moustache. There was a smile on his lips, too, and his eyes looked hard into James's. The little man met his glance composedly.
"'It's an ingenious fancy, this of yours, James,' the constable remarked. "'What, though, if your master's killed, too? That's quite possible. Count Rupert's a man to be reckoned with.'
"'If my master is killed, sir, he must be buried,' answered James.
"'In Strel, sir?' came in quick question from Zapt.
"'He won't mind where, sir.'
"'True, he won't mind, and we needn't mind for him.'
"'Why, no, sir, but to carry a body secretly from here to Strelsau.'
"'Yes, that is, as we agreed at the first, difficult. Well, it's a pretty story, but your master wouldn't approve of it, supposing he were not killed, I mean.'
"'It's a waste of time, sir, disapproving of what's done. "'He might think the story better than the truth, although it's not a good story.' "'The two men's eyes met again in a long glance.
"'Where do you come from?'
asked Zapt suddenly. "'London, sir, originally.'
"'They make good stories there?'
"'Yes, sir, and act them sometimes.' "'The instant he had spoken, James sprang to his feet and pointed out of the window. A man on horseback was cantering towards the lodge. Exchanging one quick look, both hastened to the door, and advancing some 20 yards, waited under the tree on the spot where Boris lay buried.
"'By the way,' said Zapt, "'you forgot the dog,'
and he pointed to the ground. "'The affectionate beast will be in his master's room and die there, sir.'
"'Eh, but he must rise again first.'
"'Certainly, sir. That won't be a long matter.' Zapt was still smiling in grim amusement, when the messenger came up, and, leaning from his horse, handed him a telegram. "'Special and urgent, sir,' said he. Zapt tore it open and read. It was the message that I sent in obedience to Mr. Rassendyll's orders. He would not trust my cipher, but indeed none was necessary. Zapt would understand the message, although it said simply, "'The king is in Strelsau. Wait orders at the lodge.' "'Business here in progress, but not finished. We'll wire again.' Zapt handed it to James, who took it with a respectful little bow. James read it with attention, and returned it with another bow. "'I'll attend to what it says, sir,'
he remarked.
"Yes," said Sapt. "Thanks, my man," he added to the messenger. "Here's a crown for you. If any other message comes for me, and you bring it in good time, you shall have another."
"You shall have it as quick as a horse can bring it from the station, sir."
"The king's business won't bear delay, you know," nodded Sapt.
"You shan't have to wait, sir." And with a parting salute, the fellow turned his horse and trotted away.
"You see," remarked Sapt, "that your story is quite imaginary, for that fellow can see for himself that the lodge was not burnt down last night."
"That's true, sir, but excuse me, sir."
"Pray go on, James. I've told you that I'm interested."
"He can't see that it won't burn down tonight. A fire, sir, is a thing that may happen any night." Then old Sapt suddenly burst into a roar, half speech, half laughter.
"By God, what a thing!" he roared,
and James smiled complacently.
"There's a fate about it," said the constable. "There's a strange fate about it. A man was born to it. We'd have done it before if Michael had throttled the king in that cellar, as I thought he would. Yes, by heavens, we'd have done it. Why, we wanted it. God forgive us, in our hearts, both Fritz and I wanted it. But Rudolf would have the king out. He would have him out, though he'd lost a throne, and what he wanted more by it. But he would have him out, so he thwarted the fate. But it's not to be thwarted. Young Rupert may think this new affair is his doing. No, it's the fate using him. The fate brought Rudolf here again. The fate will have him king. Well, you stare at me. Do you think I'm mad, Mr. Valet?"
"I think, sir, that you talk very good sense, if I may say so," answered James.
"Sense?" echoed Sapt with a chuckle. "I don't know about that, but the fate's there, depend on it."
The two were back in their little room now, past the door that hid the bodies of the king and his huntsmen. James stood by the table. Old Sapt roamed up and down, tugging his moustache and now and again sawing the air with his sturdy, hairy hand.
"I daren't do it," he muttered. "I daren't do it. It's a thing a man can't set his hand to of his own will. But the fate'll do it. The fate'll do it. The fate'll force it on us."
"Then we'd best be ready, sir," suggested James quietly. Sapt turned on him quickly, almost fiercely.
"They used to call me a cool hand," said he. "By Jove, what are you?"
"There's no harm in being ready, sir," said James, the servant. Sapt came to him and caught hold of his shoulders.
"Ready?"
he asked in a gruff whisper. "The oil, the firewood, the light," said James.
"Where, man, where? Do you mean by the bodies?"
"Not where the bodies are now. Each must be in the proper place."
"We must move them, then."
"Why, yes, and the dog, too." Sapt almost glared at him. Then he burst into a laugh.
"So be it," he said. "You take command. Yes, we'll be ready. The fate drives."
Then and there they set about what they had to do. It seemed, indeed, as though some strange influence were dominating Sapt. He went about the work like a man who is hardly awake. They placed the bodies each where the living man would be by night, the king in the guest room, the huntsman in the sort of cupboard where the honest fellow had wont to lie. They dug up the buried dog, Sapt chuckling convulsively, James, grave as the mute whose grim doings he seemed to travesty. They carried the shot-pierced, earth-grimed thing in, and laid it in the king's room. Then they made their piles of wood, pouring the store of oil over them, and setting bottles of spirit near, that the flames, having cracked the bottles, might gain fresh fuel. To Sapt it seemed now as if they played some foolish game that was to end with the playing, now as if they obeyed some mysterious power which kept its great purpose hidden from its instruments. Mr. Rassendyll's servant moved and arranged and ordered all as deftly as he folded his master's clothes or stropped his master's razor. Old Sapt stopped him once as he went by.
"Don't think me a mad fool because I talk of the fate," he said, almost anxiously.
"Not I, sir," answered James. I know nothing of that, but I like to be ready.
It would be a thing, muttered Sapt.
The mockery, real or assumed, in which they had begun their work, had vanished now. If they were not serious, they played at seriousness. If they entertained no intention such as their acts seemed to indicate, they could no longer deny that they had cherished a hope. They shrank, or at least Sapt shrank, from setting such a ball rolling. But they longed for the fate that would give it a kick, and they made smooth the incline down which it, when thus impelled, was to run. When they had finished their task and sat down again opposite to one another in the little front room, the whole scheme was ready, the preparations were made, all was in train. They waited only for that impulse from chance or fate which was to turn the servant's story into reality and action. And when the thing was done, Sapt's coolness, so rarely upset, yet so completely beaten by the force of that wild idea, came back to him. He lit his pipe again, and lay back in his chair, puffing freely, with a meditative look on his face. "It's 2 o'clock, sir," said James. "Something should have happened before now in Strelsau."
"Ah, but what?" asked the constable.
Suddenly, breaking on their ears, came a loud knock at the door. Absorbed in their own thoughts, they had not noticed 2 men riding up to the lodge. The visitors wore the green and gold of the king's huntsmen. The one who had knocked was Simon, the chief huntsman, and brother of Herbert, who lay dead in the little room inside.
"Rather dangerous," muttered the constable of Zender, as he hurried to the door,
James following him. Simon was astonished when Sapt opened the door.
"Beg pardon, constable, but I want to see Herbert. Can I go in?"
And he jumped down from his horse, throwing the reins to his companion.
"What's the good of your going in?" asked Sapt. "Herbert's not here."
"Not here? Then where is he?"
"Why, he went with the king this morning."
"Oh, he went with the king, sir. Then he'll be in Strelsau, I suppose."
"If you know that, Simon, you're wiser than I am."
"But the king is in Strelsau, sir."
"The deuce he is. He said nothing of going to Strelsau. He rose early and rode off with Herbert, merely saying they would be back tonight."
"He went to Strelsau, sir. I'm just from Zender, and His Majesty is known to have been in town with the Queen. They were both at Count Fritz's."
"I'm much interested to hear it, but didn't the telegram say where Herbert was?"
Simon laughed.
"Herbert's not a king, you see," he said. "Well, I'll come again tomorrow morning, for I must see him soon. He'll be back by then, sir?"
"Yes, Simon, your brother will be here tomorrow morning."
"Or what's left of him after such a 2 days of work," suggested Simon jocularly.
"Why, yes, precisely," said Sapt, biting his moustache and darting one swift glance at James. "Or what's left of him, as you say."
"And I'll bring a cart and carry the boar down to the castle at the same time, sir. At least, I suppose you haven't eaten at all?"
Sapt laughed. Simon was gratified at the tribute, and laughed even more heartily himself.
"I haven't even cooked it yet," said Sapt, "but I won't answer for it that we shan't have by tomorrow."
"All right, sir, I'll be here. By the way, there's another bit of news come on the wires. They say Count Rupert of Hentzau has been seen in the city."
"Rupert of Hentzau? Oh, pooh! Nonsense, my good Simon. He daren't show his face there for his life."
"Ah, but he may be no nonsense. Perhaps that's what took the king to Strelsau."
"It's enough to take him, if it's true," admitted Sapt.
"Well, good day, sir."
"Good day, Simon."
The 2 huntsmen rode off. James watched them for a little while. "The king," he said then, "is known to be in Strelsau. And now Count Rupert is known to be in Strelsau. How is Count Rupert to have killed the king here in the forest of Zender, sir?" Sapt looked at him almost apprehensively. "How is the king's body to come to the forest of Zender?" asked James. "Or how is the king's body to go to the city of Strelsau?"
"Stop your damned riddles," roared Sapt. "Man, are you bent on driving me into it?"
The servant came near to him and laid a hand on his shoulder. "You went into as great a thing once before, sir," said he.
"It was to save the king."
"And this is to save the queen and yourself. For if we don't do it, the truth about my master must be known." Sapt made him no answer. They sat down again in silence. There they sat, sometimes smoking, never speaking, while the tedious afternoon wore away, and the shadows from the trees of the forest lengthened. They did not think of eating or drinking. They did not move save when James rose and lit a little fire of brushwood in the grate. It grew dusk, and again James moved to light the lamp. It was hard on 6 o'clock, and still no news came from Strelsau. Then there was the sound of horses' hoofs. The two rushed to the door, beyond it, and far along the grassy road that gave approach to the hunting lodge. They forgot to guard the secret, and the door gaped open behind them. Sapt ran as he had not run for many a day, and outstripped his companion. There was a message from Strelsau. The constable, without a word of greeting, snatched the envelope from the hand of the messenger and tore it open. He read it hastily, muttering under his breath, "Good God!" Then he turned suddenly round and began to walk quickly back to James, who, seeing himself beaten in the race, had dropped to a walk. But the messenger had his cares as well as the constable. If the constable's thoughts were on a crown, so were his. He called out in indignant protest,
"I've never drawn rein since Hofbau, sir. Am I not to have my crown?"
Sapt stopped, turned and retraced his steps. He took a crown from his pocket. As he looked up in giving it, there was a queer smile on his broad, weather-beaten face.
"Aye," he said, "every man that deserves a crown shall have one, if I can give it him."
Then he turned again to James, who had now come up, and laid his hand on his shoulder.
"Come along, my kingmaker," said he.
James looked in his face for a moment. The constable's eyes met his, and the constable nodded. So they turned to the lodge where the dead king and his huntsman lay. Verily, the fate drove. End of chapter 15. Chapter 16 of Rupert of Hentzau. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please go to LibriVox.org. Recording by Andy Minter. Rupert of Hentzau. Taken from the memoirs of Fritz von Tarlenheim. By Anthony Hope. Chapter 16. A Crowd in the Königstrasse. The project that had taken shape in the thoughts of Mr. Rassendyll's servant, and had inflamed Sapt's daring mind as the dropping of a spark kindles dry shavings, had suggested itself vaguely to more than one of us in Strelsau. We did not indeed coolly face and plan it, as the little servant had, nor seize on it at once with an eagerness to be convinced of its necessity, like the constable of Zender. But it was there in my mind, sometimes figuring as a dread, sometimes as a hope, now seeming the one thing to be avoided, again the only resource against a more disastrous issue. I knew that it was in Bernenstein's thoughts no less than in my own, for neither of us had been able to form any reasonable scheme by which the living king, whom half Strelsau now knew to be in the city, could be spirited away, and the dead king set in his place. The change could take place, as it seemed, only in one way, and at one cost. The truth, or the better part of it, must be told, and every tongue set wagging with gossip and guesses concerning Rudolf Rassendyll and his relations with the Queen. Who that knows what men and women are would not have shrunk from that alternative? To adopt it was to expose the Queen to all, or nearly all, the peril she had run by the loss of the letter. We indeed assumed, influenced by Rudolf's unhesitating self-confidence, that the letter would be won back, and the mouth of Rupert of Hentzau shut, but enough would remain to furnish material for eager talk, and for conjectures unrestrained by respect or charity. Therefore, alive as we were to its difficulties and its unending risks, we yet conceived of the thing as possible, had it in our hearts, and hinted it to one another, my wife to me, I to Bernenstein, and he to me, in quick glances and half-uttered sentences that declared its presence, while shunning the open confession of it. For the Queen herself I cannot speak. Her thoughts, as I judged them, were bounded by the longing to see Mr. Rassendyll again, and dwelt on the visit that he promised as the horizon of hope. To Rudolf we had dared to disclose nothing of the part our imaginations had set him to play. If he were to accept it, the acceptance would be of his own act, because the fate that old Sapt talked of drove him, and on no persuasion of ours. As he had said, he left the rest, and had centred all his efforts on the immediate task which fell to his hand to perform, the task that was to be accomplished at the dingy old house in the Königstrasse. We were indeed awake to the fact that even Rupert's death would not make the secret safe. Rischenheim, although for the moment a prisoner and helpless, was alive and could not be mewed up for ever. Bauer was we knew not where, free to act and free to talk. Yet in our hearts we feared none but Rupert, and the doubt was not whether we could do the thing, so much as whether we should. For in moments of excitement and intense feeling, a man makes light of obstacles which look large enough as he turns reflective eyes on them in the quiet of after-days. A message in the King's name had persuaded the best part of the idle crowd to disperse reluctantly. Rudolf himself had entered one of my carriages and driven off. He started not towards the Königstrasse, but in the opposite direction. I supposed that he meant to approach his destination by a circuitous way, hoping to gain it without attracting notice. The Queen's carriage was still before my door, for it had been arranged that she was to proceed to the palace and there await tidings. My wife and I were to accompany her, and I went to her now, where she sat alone, and asked if it were her pleasure to start at once. I found her thoughtful but calm. She listened to me, and then, rising, she said, "Yes, I will go." But then she asked suddenly, "Where is the Count of Lutzau-Rischenheim?" I told her how Bernenstein kept guard over the Count in the room at the back of the house. She seemed to consider for a moment. Then she said, "I will see him. Go and bring him to me. You must be here while I talk to him, but nobody else." I did not know what she intended, but I saw no reason to oppose her wishes, and I was glad to find for her any means of employing this time of suspense. I obeyed her commands, and brought Rischenheim to her. He followed me slowly and reluctantly. His unstable mind had again jumped from rashness to despondency. He was pale and uneasy, and when he found himself in her presence, the bravado of his bearing, maintained before Bernenstein, gave place to a shamefaced sullenness. He could not meet the grave eyes that she fixed on him. I withdrew to the farther end of the room, but it was small, and I heard all that passed. I had my revolver ready to cover Rischenheim in case he should be moved to make a dash for liberty, but he was past that. Rupert's presence was a tonic that nerved him to effort and to confidence, but the force of the last dose was gone, and the man was sunk again to his natural irresolution. "My lord," she began gently, motioning him to sit, "I have desired to speak with you, because I do not wish a gentleman of your rank to think too much evil of his queen. Heaven has willed that my secret should be to you no secret, and therefore I may speak plainly. You may say my own shame should silence me. I speak to lessen my shame in your eyes, if I can." Rischenheim looked up with a dull gaze, not understanding her mood. He had expected reproaches, and met low-voiced apology. "And yet," she went on, "it is because of me that the king lies dead now, and a faithful, humble fellow also, caught in the net of my unhappy fortunes, has given his life for me, though he didn't know it. Even while we speak, it may be that a gentleman, not too old yet to learn nobility, may be killed in my quarrel, while another, whom I alone of all that know him may not praise, carries his life lightly in his hand for me. And to you, my lord, I have done the wrong of dressing a harsh deed in some cloak of excuse, making you seem to serve the king in working my punishment." Rischenheim's eyes fell to the ground, and he twisted his hands nervously in and out, the one about the other. I took my hand from my revolver. He would not move now. "I don't know," she went on, now almost dreamily, as though she spoke more to herself than to him, or had even forgotten his presence, "what end in heaven's counsel my great unhappiness has served. Perhaps I, who have place above most women, must also be tried above most, and in that trial I have failed. Yet when I weigh my misery and my temptation, to my human eyes it seems that I have not failed greatly. My heart is not yet humbled, God's work not yet done, but the guilt of blood is on my soul. Even the face of my dear love I can see now only through its scarlet mist, so that if what seemed my perfect joy were now granted me, it would come spoiled and stained and blotched." She paused, fixing her eyes on him again, but he neither spoke nor moved. "You knew my sin," she said, "the sin so great in my heart, and you knew how little my act yielded to it. Did you think, my lord, that the sin had no punishment, that you took it in hand to add shame to my suffering? Was heaven so kind that men must temper its indulgence by their severity? Yet I know that because I was wrong, you, being wrong, might seem to yourself not wrong, and in aiding your kinsman might plead that you served the king's honour. Thus, my lord, I was the cause in you of a deed that your heart could not welcome, nor your honour praise. I thank God that you have come to no more hurt by it." Rischenheim began to mutter in a low, thick voice, his eyes still cast down. "Rupert persuaded me. He said the king would be very grateful and would give me—" His voice died away, and he sat silent again, twisting his hands. "I know, I know," she said, "but you wouldn't have listened to such persuasions if my fault hadn't blinded your eyes." She turned suddenly to me, who had been standing all the while aloof, and stretched out her hands towards me, her eyes filled with tears. "Yet," said she, "your wife knows, and still loves me, Fritz." "She should be no wife of mine if she didn't," I cried, "for I and all of mine ask no better than to die for your majesty." "She knows, and yet she loves me," repeated the queen. I loved to see that she seemed to find comfort in Helga's love. It is women to whom women turn, and women whom women fear. "But Helga writes no letters," said the queen.
"Why, no," said I, and I smiled a grim smile. "Well, Rudolf Rassendyll never wooed my wife." She rose, saying,
"Come, let us go to the palace."
As she rose, Rischenheim made a quick, impulsive step towards her.
"Well, my lord," said she, turning towards him, "will you also go with me?"
"Lieutenant von Bernenstein will take care—" I began, but I stopped. The slightest gesture of her hand silenced me.
"Will you go with me?" she asked Rischenheim again. "Madam," he stammered, "madam—"
She waited. I waited also, although I had no great patience with him. Suddenly he fell on his knee, but he did not venture to take her hand. Of her own accord she came and stretched it out to him, saying sadly,
"Ah, that by forgiving I could win forgiveness."
Rischenheim caught at her hand and kissed it.
"It was not I," I heard him mutter. "Rupert set me on, and I couldn't stand out against him." "Will you go with me to the palace?" she asked, drawing her hand away, but smiling.
"The Count of Lutzau Rischenheim," I made bold to observe, "knows some things that most people do not know, madam." She turned on me with dignity, almost with displeasure.
"The Count of Lutzau Rischenheim may be trusted to be silent," she said. "We ask him to do nothing against his cousin. We ask only for his silence."
"Aye," said I, braving her anger, "but what security shall we have?"
"His word of honour, my lord."
I knew that a rebuke to my presumption lay in her calling me my lord,
for save on formal occasions she always used to call me Fritz. "His word of honour," I grumbled. "In truth, madam."
"He's right," said Rischenheim. "He's right."
"No, he's wrong," said the Queen, smiling. "The Count will keep his word given to me." Rischenheim looked at her and seemed about to address her, but then he turned to me and said in a low tone, "By heaven, I will, Tarlenheim. I'll serve her in everything."
"My lord," said she most graciously and yet very sadly, "you lighten the burden on me no less by your help than because I no longer feel your honour stained through me. Come, we will go to the palace."
And she went to him, saying,
"We will go together."
There was nothing for it but to trust him. I knew that I could not turn her. "Then I'll see if the carriage is ready," said I.
"Yes, do, Fritz," said the Queen. But as I passed, she stopped me for a moment, saying in a whisper, "Show that you trust him."
I went and held out my hand to him. He took it and pressed it.
"On my honour," he said.
Then I went out and found Bernenstein sitting on a bench in the hall. The lieutenant was a diligent and watchful young man. He appeared to be examining his revolver with sedulous care. "You can put that away," said I, rather peevishly. I had not fancied shaking hands with Rischenheim. "He's not a prisoner any longer. He's one of us now." "The deuce he is!" cried Bernenstein, springing to his feet. I told him briefly what had happened, and how the Queen had won Rupert's instrument to be her servant. "I suppose he'll stick to it," I ended, and I thought he would, though I was not eager for his help. A light gleamed in Bernenstein's eyes, and I felt a tremble in the hand that he laid on my shoulder. "There's only Bauer now," he whispered. "If Rischenheim's with us, only Bauer." I knew very well what he meant. With Rischenheim silent, Bauer was the only man, save Rupert himself, who knew the truth. The only man who threatened that great scheme which more and more filled our thoughts and grew upon us with an increasing force of attraction, as every obstacle to it seemed to be cleared out of our way. But I would not look at Bernenstein, fearing to acknowledge, even with my eyes, how my mind jumped with his. He was bolder, or less scrupulous, which you will.
"Yes, if we can shut Bauer's mouth," he went on.
"The Queen's waiting for the carriage," I interrupted snappishly. "Ah, yes, of course, the carriage." And he twisted me round till I was forced to look him in the face. Then he smiled, and even laughed a little. "Only Bauer now," said he. "And Rupert," I remarked sourly. "Oh, Rupert's dead bones by now," he chuckled. And with that he went out of the hall door and announced the Queen's approach to her servants. It must be said for young Bernenstein that he was a cheerful fellow-conspirator. His equanimity almost matched Rudolf's own. I could not rival it myself. I drove to the palace with the Queen and my wife, the other two following in a second carriage. I do not know what they said to one another on the way, but Bernenstein was civil enough to his companion when I rejoined them. With us, my wife was the principal speaker. She filled up, from what Rudolf had told her, the gaps in our knowledge of how he had spent his night in Strelsau, and by the time we arrived, we were fully informed in every detail. The Queen said little. The impulse which had dictated her appeal to Rischenheim and carried her through it seemed to have died away. She had become again subject to fears and apprehension. I saw her uneasiness when she suddenly put out her hand and touched mine, whispering, "He must be at the house by now." Our way did not lie by the house, and we came to the palace without any news of our absent chief. So I call him, for as such we all, from the Queen herself, then regarded him. She did not speak of him again, but her eyes seemed to follow me about as though she were silently asking some service of me. What it was I could not understand. Bernenstein had disappeared, and the repentant Count with him. Knowing they were together, I was in no uneasiness. Bernenstein would see that his companion contrived no treachery. But I was puzzled by the Queen's tacit appeal, and I was myself on fire for news from the Königstrasse. It was now 2 hours since Rudolf Rassendyll had left us, and no word had come of him or from him. At last I could bear it no longer. The Queen was sitting with her hand in my wife's. I had been seated on the other side of the room, for I thought they might wish to talk to one another, yet I had not seen them exchange a word. I rose abruptly and crossed the room to where they were. "Have you need of my presence, madam, or have I your permission to be away for a time?" I asked. "Where do you wish to go, Fritz?" the Queen asked, with a little start, as though I had come suddenly across her thoughts. "To the Königstrasse," said I. To my surprise, she rose and caught my hand. "God bless you, Fritz," she cried. "I don't think I could have endured it any longer, but I wouldn't ask you to go. But go, my dear friend, and bring me news of him. Oh, Fritz, I seem to dream that dream again." My wife looked up at me with a brave smile and a trembling lip. "Shall you go into the house, Fritz?" she asked. "Not unless I see need, sweetheart," said I. She came and kissed me. "Go if you are wanted," she said, and she tried to smile at the Queen, as though she risked me willingly. "I could have been such a wife, Fritz," whispered the Queen. "Yes, I could." I had nothing to say. At the moment I might not have been able to say it if I had. There is something in the helpless courage of women that makes me feel soft. We can work and fight. They sit and wait, yet they do not flinch. Now I know that if I had to sit and think about the thing, I should turn cur. Well, I went, leaving them there together. I put on plain clothes instead of my uniform, and dropped my revolver into the pocket of my coat. Thus prepared, I slipped out, and made my way on foot to the Königstrasse. It was now long past midday, but many folks were at their dinner, and the streets were not full. Two or three people recognised me, but I passed by almost unnoticed. There was no sign of stir or excitement, and the flags still floated high in the wind. Sapt had kept his secret. The men of Strelsau thought still that their king lived and was among them. I feared that Rudolf's coming would have been seen, and expected to find a crowd of people near the house. But when I reached it, there were no more than 10 or 12 idle fellows lounging about. I began to stroll up and down, with as careless an air as I could assume. Soon, however, there was a change. The workmen and business folk, their meal finished, began to come out of their houses and from the restaurants. The loafers before number 19 spoke to many of them. Some said, "Indeed," shook their heads, smiled, and passed on. They had no time to waste in staring at the king. But many waited. Lighting their cigars or cigarettes or pipes, they stood gossiping with one another, looking at their watches now and again, lest they should overstay their leisure. Thus the assembly grew to the number of 200. I ceased my walk, for the pavement was too crowded, and hung on the outskirts of the throng. As I loitered there, a cigar in my mouth, I felt a hand on my shoulder. Turning round, I saw the lieutenant. He was in uniform. By his side was Rischenheim. "You're here too, are you?" said I. "Well, nothing seems to be happening, does it?" For number 19 showed no signs of life. The shutters were up, the door closed, the little shop was not open for business that day. Bernenstein shook his head with a smile. His companion took no heed of my remark. He was evidently in a state of great agitation, and his eyes never left the door of the house. I was about to address him, when my attention was abruptly and completely diverted by a glimpse of a head caught across the shoulders of the bystanders. The fellow whom I saw wore a brown, wide-awake hat. The hat was pulled down low over his forehead, but nevertheless beneath its rim there appeared a white bandage running round his head. I could not see the face, but the bullet-shaped skull was very familiar to me. I was sure from the first moment that the bandaged man was Bauer. Saying nothing to Bernenstein, I began to steal round outside the crowd. As I went, I heard somebody saying that it was all nonsense. The king was not there. What should the king do in such a house? The answer was a reference to one of the first loungers. He replied that he did not know what the devil the king did there, but that the king or his double had certainly gone in, and had as certainly not yet come out again. I wished I could have made myself known to them, and persuaded them to go away. But my presence would have outweighed my declarations, and been taken as a sure sign that the king was in the house.
so I kept on the outskirts and worked my way unobtrusively towards the bandaged head. Evidently Bauer's hurt had not been so serious as to prevent him leaving the infirmary to which the police had carried him. He was now come to await, even as I was awaiting, the issue of Rudolf's visit to the house in the Königstrasse. He had not seen me, for he was looking at number 19 as intently as Rischenheim. Apparently neither had caught sight of the other, or Rischenheim would have shown some embarrassment, Bauer some excitement. I wormed my way quickly towards my former servant. My mind was full of the idea of getting hold of him. I could not forget Bernenstein's remark, "Only Bauer now." If I could secure Bauer, we were safe. Safe in what? I did not answer to myself, but the old idea was working in me. Safe in our secret, safe in our plan, in the plan on which we all, we here in the city and those two at the hunting lodge, had set our minds. Bauer's death, Bauer's capture, Bauer's silence, however procured, would clear the greatest hindrance from its way. Bauer stared intently at the house. I crept cautiously up behind him. His hand was in his trousers pocket. Where the curve of the elbow came, there was a space between arm and body. I slipped in my left arm and hooked it firmly inside his. He turned round and saw me. "Thus we meet again, Bauer," said I. He was for a moment flabbergasted and stared stupidly at me. "Are you also hoping to see the king?" I asked. He began to recover himself. A slow, cunning smile spread over his face. "The king?" he asked. "Well, he's in Strelsau, isn't he? Who gave you the wound to your head?" Bauer moved his arm as though he meant to withdraw it from my grasp. He found himself tightly held. "Where's that bag of mine?" I asked. I do not know what he would have answered, for at this instant there came a sound from behind the closed door of the house. It was as if someone ran rapidly and eagerly towards the door. Then came an oath, in a shrill voice, a woman's voice, but harsh and rough. It was answered by an angry cry in a girl's intonation. Full of eagerness, I drew my arm from Bauer's and sprang forward. I heard a chuckle from him, and turned round to see his bandaged head retreating rapidly down the street. I had no time to look to him, for now I saw two men, shoulder to shoulder, making their way through the crowd, regardless of anyone in their way, and paying no attention to abuse or remonstrances. They were the lieutenant and Rischenheim. Without a moment's hesitation, I set myself to push and battle a way through, thinking to join them in front. On they went, and on I went. All gave place before us in surly reluctance or frightened willingness. We three were together in the first rank of the crowd, when the door of the house was flung open and a girl ran out. Her hair was disordered, her face pale, and her eyes full of alarm. There she stood on the doorstep, facing the crowd, which in an instant grew as if by magic to three times its former size, and little knowing what she did, she cried in eager accents of sheer terror, "Help! Help! The king! The king!" End of chapter 16. Chapter 17 of Rupert of Hentzau. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please go to LibriVox.org. Recording by Andy Minter. Rupert of Hentzau. Taken from the memoirs of Fritz von Tarlenheim. By Anthony Hope. Chapter 17. Young Rupert and the Play-Actor. There rises often before my mind the picture of young Rupert, standing where Rischenheim left him, awaiting the return of his messenger, and watching for some sign that he should declare to Strelsau the death of its king, which his own hand had wrought. His image is one that memory holds clear and distinct, though time may blur the shape of greater and better men, and the position in which he was that morning gives play enough to the imagination. Save for Rischenheim, a broken reed, and Bauer, who was gone, none knew where, he stood alone against a kingdom which he had robbed of its head,
and a band of resolute men who would know no rest and no security so long as he lived. For protection he had only a quick brain, his courage, and his secret. Yet he could not fly, he was without resources till his cousin furnished them, and at any moment his opponents might find themselves able to declare the king's death, and raise the city in hue and cry after him. Such men do not repent, but it may be that he regretted the enterprise which had led him on so far, and forced on him a deed so momentous. Yet to those who knew him, it seems more likely that the smile broadened on his firm, full lips as he looked down on the unconscious city. Well, I dare say he would have been too much for me, but I wish I had been the man to find him there. He would not have had it so, for I believe that he asked no better than to cross swords again with Rudolf Rassendyll and set his fortunes on the issue. Down below, the old woman was cooking a stew for her dinner, now and then grumbling to herself that the Count of Lutzau Rischenheim was so long away, and Bauer the rascal drunk in some pothouse. The kitchen door stood open, and through it could be seen the girl Rosa, busily scrubbing the tiled floor. Her colour was high, and her eyes bright. From time to time she paused in her task, and raising her head seemed to listen. The time at which the king needed her was past, but the king had not come. How little the old woman knew for whom she listened. All her talk had been of Bauer, why Bauer did not come, and what could have befallen him. It was grand to hold the king's secret for him, and she would hold it with her life, for he had been kind and gracious to her, and he was her man of all the men in Strelsau. Bauer was a stumpy fellow. The Count of Hentzau was handsome, handsome as the devil, but the king was her man, and the king had trusted her. She would die before hurt should come to him. There were wheels in the street, quick rolling wheels. They seemed to stop a few doors away, then to roll on again past the house. The girl's head was raised. The old woman, engrossed in her stewing, took no heed. The girl's straining ear caught a rapid step outside. Then it came, the knock, the sharp knock, followed by five light ones. The old woman heard now, dropping her spoon into the pot. She lifted the mess off the fire, and turning round, saying, "There's the rogue at last. Open the door for him, Rosa." Before she spoke, Rosa had darted down the passage. The door opened and shut again. The old woman waddled to the threshold of the kitchen. The passage and the shop were dark behind the closed shutters, but the figure by the girl's side was taller than Bauer's. "Who's there?" cried Mother Holf sharply. "The shop's shut to-day. You can't come in." "But I am in," came the answer, and Rudolf stepped towards her. The girl followed a pace behind, her hands clasped and her eyes alight with excitement. "Don't you know me?" asked Rudolf, standing opposite the old woman and smiling down on her. There, in the dim light of the low-roofed passage, Mother Holf was fairly puzzled. She knew the story of Mr. Rassendyll. She knew that he was again in Ruritania. It was no surprise to her that he should be in Strelsau, but she did not know that Rupert had killed the king, and she had not seen the king close at hand since his illness, and his beard impaired what had been a perfect likeness. In fine, she could not tell whether it were indeed the king who spoke to her, or his counterfeit. "Who are you?" she asked, curt and blunt in her confusion. The girl broke in with an amused laugh. "Why, it's the—" She paused. Perhaps the king's identity was a secret. Rudolf nodded to her. "Tell her who I am," said he. "Why, mother, it's the king!" whispered Rosa, laughing and blushing. "The king, mother!"
"Aye, if the king's alive, I'm the king," said Rudolf. I suppose he wanted to find out how much the old woman knew. She made no answer, but stared up at his face. In her bewilderment she forgot to ask how he had learnt the signal that gained him admission. "I've come to see the Count of Hentzau," Rudolf continued. "Take me to him at once." The old woman was across his path in a moment, all defiant, arms akimbo.
"Nobody can see the Count. He's not here," she blurted out.
"What? Can't the king see him? Not even the king?"
"King!" she cried, peering at him. "Are you the king?" Rosa burst out laughing. "Mother, you must have seen the king 100 times, she laughed.
"The king or his ghost, what does it matter?" said Rudolf lightly. The old woman drew back with an appearance of sudden alarm.
"His ghost, is he?" "His ghost?" rang out in the girl's merry laugh. "Why, here's the king himself, Mother. You don't look much like a ghost, sir."
Mother Holf's face was livid now, and her eyes staring fixedly. Perhaps it shot into her brain that something had happened to the king, and that this man had come because of it. This man, who was indeed the image, and might have been the spirit of the king. She leant against the doorpost, her broad bosom heaving under her scanty stuff gown. Yet still, was it not the king?
"God help us,"
she muttered in fear and bewilderment. "He helps us, never fear," said Rudolf Rassendyll. "Where is Count Rupert?" The girl had caught alarm from her mother's agitation.
"He's upstairs in the attic at the top of the house, sir," she whispered in frightened tones, with a glance that fled from her mother's terrified face to Rudolf's set eyes and steady smile.
What she said was enough for him. He slipped by the old woman and began to mount the stairs. The two watched him, Mother Holf as though fascinated, the girl alarmed but still triumphant. She had done what the king bade her. Rudolf turned the corner of the first landing and disappeared from their sight. The old woman, swearing and muttering, stumbled back into her kitchen, set her stew on the fire and began to stir it, her eyes set on the flames and careless of the pot. The girl watched her mother for a moment, wondering how she could think of the stew, not guessing that she turned the spoon without a thought of what she did. Then she began to crawl quickly but noiselessly up the staircase in the track of Rudolf Rassendyll. She looked back once. The old woman stirred with a monotonous circular movement of her fat arm. Rosa, bent half-double, skimmed upstairs till she came in sight of the king, whom she was so proud to serve. He was on the top landing now, outside the door of a large attic where Rupert of Hentzau was lodged. She saw him lay his hand on the latch of the door. His other hand rested in the pocket of his coat. From the room no sound came. Rupert may have heard the step outside and stood motionless to listen. Rudolf opened the door and walked in. The girl darted breathlessly up the remaining steps, and coming to the door, just as it swung back on the latch, crouched down by it, listening to what passed within, catching glimpses of forms and movements through the chinks of the crazy hinge and the crevices where the wood of the panel sprung and left a narrow eye-hole for her absorbed gazing. Rupert of Hentzau had no thought of ghosts. The men he killed lay still where they fell and slept where they were buried, and he had no wonder at the sight of Rudolf Rassendyll. It told him no more than that Rischenheim's errand had fallen out ill, at which he was not surprised, and that his old enemy was again in his path, at which, as I verily believe, he was more glad than sorry. As Rudolf entered, he had been halfway between window and table. He came forward to the table now, and stood leaning the points of two fingers on the unpolished, dirty white deal.
"Ah, the play-actor," said he, with a gleam of his teeth and a toss of his curls, while his second hand, like Mr. Rassendyll's, rested in the pocket of his coat.
Mr. Rassendyll himself has confessed that in the old days it went against the grain with him when Rupert called him a play-actor. He was a little older now, and his temper more difficult to stir.
"Yes, the play-actor," he answered, smiling, "with a shorter part this time, though."
"What part today? Isn't it the old one? The king with the pasteboard crown?" asked Rupert, sitting down at the table. "Faith, we shall do handsomely in Ruritania. You have a pasteboard crown, and I, humble man though I am, have given the other one a heavenly crown. What a brave show! But perhaps I tell you news."
"No, I know what you've done."
"I take no credit. It was more the dog's doing than mine," said Rupert carelessly. "However, there it is, and dead he is, and there's an end of it. What's your business, play-actor?"
At the repetition of this last word, to her so mysterious, the girl outside pressed her eyes more eagerly to the chink,
and strained her ears to listen more sedulously. And what did the Count mean by the other one and a heavenly crown? "Why not call me King?" asked Rudolf. "They call you that in Strelsau?" "Those that know I'm here." "And they are?" "Some few score." "And thus," said Rupert, waving an arm towards the window, "the town is quiet, and the flags fly." "You've been waiting to see them lowered." "A man likes to have some notice taken of what he has done," Rupert complained. "However, I can get them lowered when I will." "By telling your news? Would that be good for yourself?" "Forgive me, not that way. Since the king has two lives, it is but nature that he should have two deaths."
"And when he has undergone the second?"
"I shall live at peace, my friend, on a certain source of income that I possess." He tapped his breast pocket with a slight defiant laugh. "In these days," said he, "even queens must be careful about their letters. We live in moral times."
"You don't share the responsibility for it," said Rudolf, smiling.
"I make my little protest. But what's your business, play-actor, for I think you're rather tiresome."
Rudolf grew grave. He advanced towards the table and spoke in low, serious tones. "My lord, you're alone in this matter now. Rischenheim is a prisoner. Your rogue Bauer I encountered last night and broke his head."
"Ah, you did?"
"You have what you know of in your hands. If you yield, on my honour I will save your life."
"You don't desire my blood, then, most forgiving play-actor?"
"So much that I daren't fail to offer you life," answered Rudolf Rassendyll. "Come, sir, your plan has failed. Give up the letter."
Rupert looked at him thoughtfully. "You'll see me safe off if I give it to you?" he asked.
"I'll prevent your death, yes, and I'll see you safe."
"Where to?"
"To a fortress, where a trustworthy gentleman will guard you."
"For how long, my dear friend?"
"I hope for many years, my dear Count."
"In fact, I suppose, as long as—"
"Heaven leaves you to the world, Count, it's impossible to set you free."
"That's the offer, then?"
"The extreme limit of indulgence," answered Rudolf. Rupert burst into a laugh, half of defiance, yet touched with the ring of true amusement. Then he lit a cigarette and sat puffing and smiling.
"I should wrong you by straining your kindness so far," said he, and in wanton insolence, seeking again to show Mr. Rassendyll the mean esteem in which he held him, and the weariness his presence was, he raised his arms and stretched them above his head, as a man does in the fatigue of tedium. "Hey-ho!" he yawned. But he had overshot the mark this time. With a sudden swift bound, Rudolf was upon him. His hands gripped Rupert's wrists, and with his greater strength he bent back the Count's pliant body till trunk and head lay flat on the table. Neither man spoke. Their eyes met. Each heard the other's breathing, and felt the vapour of it in his face. The girl outside had seen the movement of Rudolf's figure, but her cranny did not serve her to show her the two where they were now. She knelt on her knees in ignorant suspense. Slowly, and with a patient force, Rudolf began to work his enemy's arms towards one another. Rupert had read his design in his eyes, and resisted with tense muscles. It seemed as though his arms must crack, but at last they moved. Inch by inch they were driven closer. Now the elbows almost touched, now the wrists joined in reluctant contact. The sweat broke out on the Count's brow, and stood in large drops on Rudolf's. Now the wrists were side by side, and slowly the long sinewy fingers of Rudolf's right hand, that held one wrist already in their vice, began to creep round the other. The grip seemed to have half numbed Rupert's arms, and his struggles grew fainter. Round both wrists the sinewy fingers climbed and coiled. Gradually and timidly the grasp of the other hand was relaxed and withdrawn. Would the one hold both? With a great spasm of effort, Rupert put it to the proof. The smile that bent Mr. Rassendyll's lips gave the answer. He could hold both. With one hand he could hold both. Not for long, no, but for an instant. And then, in the instant, his left hand, free at last, shot to the breast of the Count's coat. It was the same that he had worn at the hunting lodge, and was ragged and torn from the boarhound's teeth. Rudolf tore it further open, and his hand dashed in.
"God's curse on you!" snarled Rupert of Hentzau.
But Mr. Rassendyll still smiled. Then he drew out a letter. A glance at it showed him the Queen's seal. As he glanced, Rupert made another effort. The one hand, wearied out, gave way, and Mr. Rassendyll had no more than time to spring away, holding his prize. The next moment he had his revolver in his hand, none too soon, for Rupert of Hentzau's barrel faced him, and they stood thus, opposite to one another, with no more than 3 or 4 feet between the mouths of their weapons. There is indeed much that may be said against Rupert of Hentzau, the truth about him well-nigh forbidding that charity of judgment which we are taught to observe towards all men. But neither I, nor any man who knew him, ever found in him a shrinking from danger or a fear of death. It was no feeling such as these, but rather a cool calculation of chances that now stayed his hand. Even if he were victorious in the duel, and both did not die, yet the noise of the firearms would greatly decrease his chances of escape. Moreover, he was a noted swordsman, and convinced that he was Mr. Rassendyll's superior in that exercise. The steel offered him at once a better prospect for victory, and more hope of a safe fight. So he did not pull his trigger, but maintaining his aim the while, said, "I'm not a street bully, and I don't excel in rough and tumble. Will you fight now like a gentleman? There's a pair of blades in the case yonder." Mr. Rassendyll, in his turn, was keenly alive to the peril that still hung over the Queen. To kill Rupert would not save her if he himself also were shot and left dead, or so helpless that he could not destroy the letter. And while Rupert's revolver was at his heart, he could not tear it up, nor reach the fire that burnt on the other side of the room. Nor did he fear the result of a trial with steel, for he had kept himself in practice and improved his skill since the days when he first came to Strelsau. "As you will," said he, "provided we settle the matter here and now. The manner is the same to me. Put your revolver on the table, then, and I'll lay mine by the side of it." "I beg your pardon," smiled Rudolf, "but you must lay yours down first."
"I'm to trust you, it seems, but you won't trust me."
"Precisely. You know that you can trust me. You know that I can't trust you." A sudden flush swept over Rupert of Hentzau's face. There were moments when he saw in the mirror of another's face or words the estimation in which honourable men held him, and I believe that he hated Mr. Rassendyll most fiercely, not for thwarting his enterprise, but because he had more power than any other man to show him that picture. His brows knit in a frown, and his lips shut tight.
"Ay, but though you won't fire, you'll destroy the letter," he sneered. "I know your fine distinctions."
"Again, I beg your pardon. You know very well that although all Strelsau were at the door, I wouldn't touch the letter." With an angry muttered oath, Rupert flung his revolver on the table. Rudolf came forward and laid his by it. Then he took up both, and crossing to the mantelpiece, laid them there. Between them he placed the Queen's letter. A bright blaze burnt in the grate. It needed but the slightest motion of his hand to set the letter beyond all danger. But he placed it carefully on the mantelpiece, and with a slight smile on his face turned to Rupert, saying, "Now, shall we resume the bout that Fritz von Tarlenheim interrupted in the forest of Zender?" All this while they had been speaking in subdued accents, resolution in one, anger in the other, keeping the voice in even, deliberate lowness. The girl outside caught only a word here and there, but now suddenly the flash of steel gleamed on her eyes through the crevice of the hinge. She gave a sudden gasp, and pressing her face closer to the opening, listened and looked,
for Rupert of Hentzau had taken the swords from their case and put them on the table. With a slight bow, Rudolf took one, and the two assumed their positions. Suddenly, Rupert lowered his point. The frown vanished from his face, and he spoke in his usual bantering tone. "By the way," said he, "perhaps we are letting our feelings run away with us. Have you more of a mind now to be king of Ruritania? If so, I am ready to be the most faithful of your subjects." "You honour me, Count. Provided, of course, that I am one of the most favoured and the richest. Come, come, the fool is dead now. He lived like a fool, and he died like a fool. The place is empty. A dead man has no rights and suffers no wrongs. Damn it, that's good law, isn't it? Take his place and his wife. You can pay my price then. Or are you still so virtuous? Faith, how little some men learn from the world they live in. If I had your chance..." "Come, Count, you'd be the last man to trust Rupert of Hentzau, if I made it worth his while. But he's a man who would take the pay and betray his associate." Again Rupert flushed. When he next spoke, his voice was hard, cold, and low. "By God, Rudolf Rassendyll," said he, "I'll kill you here and now." "I ask no better than that you should try." "And then I'll proclaim that woman for what she is in all Strelsau." A smile came on his lips as he watched Rudolf's face. "Guard yourself, my lord," said Mr. Rassendyll. "Ay, for no better than..." "There, man, I am ready for you." For Rudolf's blade had touched his in warning. The steel jangled. The girl's pale face was at the crevice of the hinge. She heard the blades cross again and again. Then one would run up the other with a sharp, grating slither. At times she caught a glimpse of a figure in quick forward lunge or rapid, wary withdrawal. Her brain was almost paralysed. Ignorant of the mind and heart of young Rupert, she could not conceive that he tried to kill the king. Yet the words she had caught sounded like the words of men quarrelling, and she could not persuade herself that the gentlemen fenced only for pastime. They were not speaking now, but she heard their hard breathing and the movement of their unresting feet on the bare boards of the floor. Then a cry rang out, clear and merry, with the fierce hope of triumph. "Nearly, nearly!" She knew the voice for Rupert of Hentzau's, and it was the king who answered calmly, "Nearly isn't quite." Again she listened. They seemed to have paused for a moment, for there was no sound save of hard breathing and deep-drawn pants of men who rest an instant in the midst of intense exertion. Then came again the clash and the slitherings, and one of them crossed into her view. She knew the tall figure, and she saw the red hair. It was the king. Backward, step by step, he seemed to be driven, coming nearer and nearer to the door. At last there was no more than a foot between him and her. Only the crazy panel prevented her from putting out her hand to touch him. Again the voice of Rupert rang out in rich exultation. "I have you now. Say your prayers, King Rudolf." Say your prayers? Then they fought. It was earnest, not play. And it was the king, her dear king, who was in great peril of his life. For an instant she knelt, still watching. Then, with a low cry of terror, she turned and ran headlong down the steep stairs. Her mind could not tell what to do, but her heart cried out that she must do something for her king. Reaching the ground floor, she ran with wide-open eyes into the kitchen. The stew was on the hob. The old woman still held the spoon, but she had ceased to stir and fallen into a chair. "He's killing the king! He's killing the king!" cried Rosa, seizing her mother by the arm. "Mother, what shall we do? He's killing the king." The old woman looked up with dull eyes and a stupid, cunning smile. "Leave him alone," she said. "There's no king here." "Yes, yes, he's upstairs in the Count's room. They're fighting, he and the Count of Hentzau. Mother, Count Rupert will kill." "Leave them alone. He's the king." "He's no king," muttered the old woman again. For an instant Rosa stood looking down on her in helpless despair. Then a light flashed into her eyes. "I must call for help," she cried.
The old woman seemed to spring to sudden life. She jumped up and caught her daughter by the shoulder. "No, no," she whispered in quick accents. You don't know. Leave them alone, you fool. It's not our business. Leave them alone. Let me go, mother. Let me go. Mother, I must help the king."
"I'll not let you go," said Mother Holf. But Rosa was young and strong. Her heart was fired with terror for the king's danger.
"I must go," she cried, and she flung her mother's grasp off from her, so that the old woman was thrown back into her chair, and the spoon fell from her hand and clattered on the tiles. But Rosa turned and fled down the passage and through the shop. The bolts delayed her trembling fingers for an instant. Then she flung the door wide. A new amazement filled her eyes at the sight of the eager crowd before the house. Then her eyes fell on me, where I stood between the lieutenant and Rischenheim, and she uttered her wild cry, "Help! The king!" With one bound I was by her side and in the house, while Bernenstein cried, "Quicker!" from behind. End of chapter 17.
Check engine light on? Take the guesswork out of your check engine light with O'Reilly Veriscan. It's free. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, O'Reilly Auto Parts.